Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunther Wolf, and I'm today reaching you all from home, where we are all confined in home office. We are talking about the coronavirus and the European economic response, and in particular, how long this crisis will last and what should be the fiscal response and also the monetary response. And with me today are Maria de Mertzis, Bruegel's Deputy Director. Hello, Maria.
Hello there.
And Jean Pisani Ferry, Bruegel's Senior Fellow and former Director. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Gunther.
So we've had a lot of active discussions these last days and weeks, obviously, on what's going on. We fear that we are in for probably the biggest drop in GDP in the post-World War II history. Jean, you have circulated a note from the Imperial College which discusses different strategies to suppress or to mitigate the virus. Can you just walk us through this report and give us your take on how long you think this crisis, this health crisis, could last?
That we don't know, but this is an important report. I mean, we should emphasize that it's a report, it's being discussed. There are already papers out saying that some assumptions are disputable, but it's good that this discussion is being held. And basically what the report says is that based on simulations, it's an entirely simulation-based report, but the simulations are fairly transparent. That's a pure mitigation strategy that's aims at slowing down the pace of contagion is going to have much too high death toll implication to be acceptable. So the alternative is suppression. And in a way, all European countries have moved from mitigation to trying to suppress by confining people at home. And what he says is that this strategy can be effective in the short term, but if the population hasn't developed herd immunity, then the moment you lift the suppression, the confinement, it starts again. So it's not a very effective strategy unless it's kept for a very long time until the vaccine has been found. And I don't know, you know, how reliable it is. I mean, it's all very sensitive to parameters, to assumptions, etc. But what it is telling us is that we're in it perhaps for longer than initially expected, because all the economic strategy of national governments and the EU has been predicated on a short crisis. Short meaning less than 6 months, perhaps 3 months. If we're in it for much longer, that raises fundamental question about the strategy, the economic sustainability, and the fiscal sustainability of the strategy.
I mean, just to understand, so the suppression really means we are all locked down in basically at home or practice what is called social distancing, meaning physical distancing, actually. So keeping a distance of several meters to each other for an extended period of time, which would mean that many sectors and many companies really can't operate. Restaurants can operate, if at all, only at a limited extent. Airlines can't operate. I mean, essentially, a significant part of the economy would be shut down. Is that my understanding? And then, basically, if we continue that strategy, would it mean we are locked until we have a vaccine? Or how do you read the report?
I read your report of saying something like that. Now, there is a way out, which is suggested, and we've discussed that with our colleagues based in Asia, which is being experimented in Korea, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, which is much more tracking of individuals, testing and tracking, so that it can only start from a situation where the number of cases is very limited, and then each new case is being monitored and tracked. And so you can contain the contagion by actually seeing who is getting the virus. And I think it's, we have to analyze seriously the experience of those countries. I mean, it's impressive. In Korea, you find those, you know, data with patient 31 and the number of people who were affected by him or her. I think it was her. In Hong Kong, you find a map with the location of all cases, etc. So we suggest that technology can help tracking, but that, first it has to start from after suppression. And second, the fundamental questions about privacy, about civil liberties that are being raised by such a strategy. But I think it's most probably a way we should be exploring and also trying to find out how to make it acceptable from just an individualistic European type civil liberty standpoint.
Okay, Maria, so you've heard we might be in for many months of lockdowns unless we find a magic vaccine or we find a wonderful solution that will allow us to basically track sick people with mobile phones and artificial intelligence. So this could last for quite a moment. So what's your sort of back of the envelope best estimate of what does it mean for GDP? Are we really in for the worst fall in GDP since World War II?
Well, first let me say that what Jean described to us is really pointing to a scenario that is unthinkable, right? I mean, this is not something that we are, I believe, prepared to do. If you think about Europe leading on GDPR and then confronted with a shock like this, that is going to necessitate a complete change of tack in the way that we deal with our privacy. You know, how ready are we to deal with something like this? So these are the difficult questions. So I'm going to leave these to the experts to answer. Back to the economics of it. It's very difficult to try and design scenario, but I would say that if we were to lose 2 months of GDP activity in the EU or in the euro area, and you can get to the 2 months in very different ways. You can have, you know, every month you lose half of the production, or you can use 1 month and everything shuts down. But if you take ballpark numbers, let's say 2 months of starting production, you are losing about 10%. If you know, in a good scenario, you will be losing about 10% of the annual production of GDP. So any country that produces 100 in 1 year, it would be reasonable, in my view, to assume that you're going to lose at least 10%. There are more, say, pessimistic scenarios out there saying that it might be 20%. But if we start with 10%, I think that's probably going to be something, at this point, realistic. These are unprecedented numbers. Any of you who have gone to the supermarket to stock up on goods, and you have seen empty shelves, this is pretty shocking, actually, to see empty shelves in the Western world from Saturday to Monday. This is actually quite unprecedented. And it does resonate with kind of some war-type scenarios. Only this time, the enemy is invisible, right? But I think that our thinking in terms of how to react to the economic shock that we're seeing needs to be done with these images in mind. We need wartime types of measures to try and deal with the economic impact of this virus.
So you almost sound like the French president that, has already talked about war type measures. I think if I perhaps just add, I think it's difficult to, of course, know how big the impact is. But I think there is no question to my mind that these shutdown measures that we are seeing don't bring GDP down to 0 or 50%, but certainly bring GDP down by 10, 20 or more percent, because, I mean, there's significant parts of our economy that depend on a sort of daily basis on contacts. And while we are all digitally savvy, it's difficult to imagine that this will can be fully replaced. So I think we are really in for a very significant downturn. And in our paper that we published last week, we advocated that we need to really address one key vulnerability, which is that, in a sense, we are coming now to the economic policy response. One key vulnerability is that companies essentially see their revenues fall very significantly, while their costs continue to be there. So we continue to have to pay our employees, we continue to have to pay for capital, but the revenues are falling. And so very quickly, you don't only end up in liquidity shortages, but you also end up actually in actual solvency concerns, because the revenues are gone, the costs are there, so you become very quickly insolvent. So I think one key issue here is really, how can we transfer money to companies or relieve the burden on companies, the cost burden on companies, so that they can continue to operate and not go immediately into bankruptcy. In the paper last week, we advocated for something like 2.5% of GDP per quarter reduction in social security contributions. That would greatly help with cash flow constraints, but also really alleviate solvency concerns in the corporate sector. Now, I guess the question is always, when it comes to such bold and big measures, how can we really do them? Can we do them quickly enough? And what are the implications for this also at the European level? Are we actually capable of doing these kind of big ballpark numbers? But I think my sense is we really should be able, and we should be trying to do this, because also if we don't do it, the rebound that we all hope for and that Jean, you talked about at the beginning, is actually very unlikely. If once companies all are bankrupt, I mean, the rebound will take much longer than in a situation where the companies are still there and, you know, once they can open up again, they can operate. So the shop that is being closed won't reopen, but there will have to be some new shop being created. So let's try to preserve as much as possible the companies and preserve bankruptcies. But how to do this? How can we mobilize the fiscal resources for this? And what does it mean for the Eurozone? Jean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, let's assume for a moment that we are out of it by September. Then the response is pretty clear. It's exactly what you said, is to preserve every company that can be preserved, is to ensure that employees do not suffer. It's basically a sort of generalized bailout strategy by the state. That should be done in large part through transfers. For example, Kurzarbeit, as it's known in Germany. We have different names for it in different countries. It's a very effective response. It's being actually implemented on an unprecedented scale. France just introduced yesterday a measure that provides 85% of the wage to every employee put on Kurzarbeit. And that's the wage bill is completely covered by the government. So it's really extensive. It costs in principle something like 10 billion for 2 months. That's the estimate by the government. We don't know, it's an open-ended scheme. So you don't know how many companies and how many employees would apply. That's the type of strategy. And for companies, you have to reach out to individual companies. I mean, the system now in place in many countries is to provide credit guarantees, which is good. There is a problem of granularity. How do you reach each and every company? I mean, in my country, there are 2.5 million companies. Well, 1 million are just individual businesses, but 1.5 with employees. That's a lot. So you can go through the banking system with the guarantees. Hopefully it works, but we don't know, because banks are also in trouble in this type of situation. So even if it's guaranteed, are you sure that banks are going to be willing to expand the balance sheet by providing this guarantee? They're not only, I mean, this does not require any additional capital, obviously, because it's fully guaranteed. But there's a problem with the size of the balance sheet, with liquidity, etc. So there's a question of whether the strategy of going through the banking system is enough. Now, I think on the whole, governments are reacting in the right way. The question then You know, it's a question of plumbing, as we're discussing. You know, how, are you sure that you're going to be effective and reach the beneficiaries? And the second question is a question of sustainability, if the crisis lasts for longer.
Yes, so we have already discussed the sustainability issue among ourselves, obviously, and let's talk a bit about really also what all of this means for the Eurozone. I mean, obviously, some countries have low debt to GDP levels and they are institutionally healthy and the productivity trend growth is fine. And so those countries can afford to provide a 10% or 20% of GDP bailout essentially to the entire corporate sector and afterwards just continue to operate. So basically socializing part of the corporate losses. In other countries, things look perhaps less nice. I have to say, of course, the ECB's press conference from last week reinforced doubts about the integrity of the Eurozone and made it more difficult for some countries to refinancing itself. So the spreads, to be concrete, spreads of Italy have gone up very substantially since last Thursday, even though the ECB clearly said that it was a communication mistake. I mean, markets do want to see where do we stand and will the Eurozone actually send strong signals of staying together so that interest rates remain low? Because one thing is clear, without low interest rates, debt very quickly becomes unsustainable. So it's absolutely crucial that spreads don't explode. The question is, how do we get there and what are the strategies? And we've had a long debate, Maria, Jean, you and other colleagues on what are the strategies. There's even a discussion on Eurobonds. There's a discussion on OMT. There is a discussion on ESM support. And there's a discussion on quantitative easing, beefing that up. Maria, you wrote a piece saying OMT is not the right strategy. Do you want to just sort of give us the main argument?
Well, yeah, I mean, OMT comes with conditionality, and that conditionality is just that, conditionality. There have been arguments around that given the circumstances, this conditionality needs to be light. I think that light conditionality, in my view, is an oxymoron. You either have it or you don't. You just can't have light conditionality. It could possibly be an effective way of helping the Eurozone, but it's not. I don't think that the country in question, whichever country asks for OMT, would actually accept the idea that and take the risk of having something called a light conditionality. Moreover, I mean, in circumstances like now, it needs to have full power to decide for itself how to proceed. I mean, quickly and very effectively decide what is the right measures to take. So I actually think that going down that route where you willingly give up your ability to decide for your own nation is not a good idea. And then the question is, what do you do instead? I mean, and again, I think that in order to begin to answer this question, we need to do some blue sky thinking here. Going down the list of tools that are available to us, which are tools that are designed for, normal times or, even perturbed times, but not as perturbed as we're seeing right now, won't do. We need to start thinking about things that are different. So then I think a good exercise to do is to go down that list. What is available out there? What can we do or what do we need to put in place in order to try and absorb some of the shocks? And here, you need to go down the different instruments. I think, the ECB, what can the ECB do differently? What can the fiscal authorities do differently? What can the fiscal authorities do differently coordinated at the EU? And what else is out there? Do you think that QE will do it? The Fed just announced 700 billion. That's about 3 or 4% of US GDP, something that order of magnitude. That is a big number. QE means that it buys bonds out of firms. Is this a well-targeted instrument to achieve the help that you and Jean talked about earlier on? I'm not entirely sure that this is really a stimulus what we need. Here we're talking about support, not necessarily a stimulus.
Yeah.
What about then the fiscal authorities? If all countries in the EU issued debt, so they went massively into markets and they issued debt, what about that? Would that do it? That is, of course, one way of doing it. And I think for the moment, this is how countries are financing themselves. But remember, this is going to put pressure on the price of bonds, and therefore the spreads will go up, and countries will have different impacts on their spreads. And therefore, their ability to use fiscal policy is going to be different by the pressure that will be put on them, right? A massive increase of fiscal by different countries will put pressure on the spreads. Coordinated action. We like to talk about blue bonds or red bonds at Bruegel. This means debt mutualization. I mean, I believe that this word is not a very accepted word in many countries in Europe, but this is indeed an instrument of that we will have to create in order to do that. So I think that is probably something that we need to think about. And then the last thing that we don't talk about is this idea of monetization. Of course, monetization is not allowed in the euro area now. Do we need to think about temporary suspension of monetary financing? It would have to be done very, very intelligently and for very short periods of time. But is this perhaps an instrument? It will have advantages in the sense that it will give all countries in the EU, in the euro area, the ability to actually do fiscal support in ways that pure fiscal policy wouldn't. But again, this is not an easy instrument to construct. So right. I'd like us to spend a little time thinking about, in blue sky thinking, about different instruments that in normal circumstances look impossible, but in current circumstances ought to be part of the suite of instruments.
I mean, this was a lot of different elements now, just to unpack this perhaps a bit for our listeners. So I think there's basically the option of QE and expanding QE very significantly, meaning the ECB and the national central banks would increase their purchases of sovereign bonds massively. I mean, currently what is planned until the end of the year is to buy something like 300 billion euros worth of sovereign bonds, eurozone sovereign bonds. One could increase that to, for example, 1,200. That would be roughly 10% of eurozone GDP, but would be less than half of what the ECB currently holds on its balance sheet in terms of national sovereign bonds. So I think this would be a perfectly feasible way of doing it, and it wouldn't be breaching any treaties. Wouldn't also be monetary financing, because it's a monetary policy operation dealing with the fragmentation of the monetary policy transmission mechanism that we are currently seeing. So I personally tend to like this option quite a lot. But you also mentioned options such as blue bond, red bond, where I have to say I'm a bit skeptical at this juncture, not only because it requires a very strong institutional structure, but also because it already tries to do something like, these are the good bonds and these are the bad bonds. And I think in a situation like the current one, differentiating between different bonds has a very significant cost. And so I'm not sure we need that. I think this is a symmetric shock. But then there's the ESM OMT option and what it means for conditionality. And I think, Jean, you've been doing some thinking on this. Why don't you walk us a bit through what this means?
Yeah. Well, I think any answer has to be immediate and massive. Immediate because as we speak, the Italian spread is going up. So the risk of Italy being taken out of the market is a very serious one. Not immediately, but we've seen that before. Every day the spread goes up and then you move to the bad equilibrium where clearly at this level of interest rate, it's unsustainable and it's self-reinforcing. So it's urgent. So I would rule out anything that requires, complicated new schemes. Second, it has to be massive for the reason we gave, that we're speaking of really big numbers. So we're speaking of an action in terms of the proportion of GDP that is unprecedented. So the ECB essentially, so we're speaking of the states issuing and they need a backstop. So the question is, can the ECB provide the backstop both legally and effectively? Mm-hmm. There are two types of instruments. There is the asset purchase program, QE, and there is the OMT, which has never been used, but was designed at the time in 2012, at the time of the euro crisis, as a response to a potential situation where a large country would risk losing access to the market. Now, the asset purchase program, the ECB can do a lot, but it's not designed for this type of situation. It's not designed to do yield curve control for a particular country. It's meant to be a monetary instrument to address the problems of the zero lower bound for the Eurozone as a whole. And I think it's not, I mean, the ECB can have a lot of possibilities, obviously, to tweak here and there. I mean, any rule, the capital key rules, the 33% rules, so the limits are self-imposed limits. The ECB can change them. But the question is, how far can you tweak an instrument that's designed to address a common problem, to address problems with markets doubting the ability of some member states to repay the debt? I think they're the limits, and the limits to the credibility of using the asset purchase program to this end, which brings me to the idea of the OMT. So to activate the OMT, which would be basically the ECB buying the bonds of the, or this, of that country in order to control the rise of the spread. I mean, to do the opposite of, or to do exactly what, the, what Christine Lagarde said, the ECB is not in the business of doing, and it's true that in normal time it's not in the business of doing it. That requires a program, that requires a framework. And that framework must be there, because you can't start saying, I'm going to control the yield or the spread on the bonds of this particular country without some, you know, guarantee that this country is going to behave in a way that's compatible with the common rules. So I think we need conditionality. So this conditionality has to be extremely simple and light. It has to be, do what you're doing and what we all agree we should be doing in this crisis to address the immediate consequences of the health crisis, and commit to wind down everything once the crisis is over. That should be the conditionality, because this crisis doesn't come from, you know, a particular behavior of a particular member state. It comes from, it's purely exogenous. So that would be simple. And I would say, if the maximum number of countries apply to this additional program with the SM, that opened the way for the ECB then to act without the stigma of being the one country that has to apply to a program. To me, this is the best solution. This is the most credible. And this is the one that can be the most effective over time in difficult conditions.
Okay, thank you, Jean. I think this is, of course, a big debate we can have on whether you know, the QE road is the best or the OMT road is the best. But I think we all agree on the fact that something big needs to be done, and it needs to be done rather quickly, because the more you wait, the bigger the cost of acting later, and the bigger also the impact on the economy. Perhaps a way to do this is start with a bigger QE, but then see if that's not enough. You have to add the OMT element to it. And I actually think there will be, on the side of the rest of the Eurozone, there will be lots of support. I mean, I don't see people really massively objecting to an OMT type program in such a situation of an exogenous shock. So this old debate on whether we should help or not, I mean, this is not going to be the prime focus at this stage. But anyway, I think Maria, perhaps a very quick, just a one-liner at the end, and then we want to end.
I wanted to say that I don't think that QE would be of any use to Greece. Greece doesn't have access to QE, but actually, the more I think of it, even if it did, it wouldn't help, because most of the debt is actually in official hands. It's not in the private sector. So QE for Greece really wouldn't make any difference. So I think Greece is now looking for very different things. Just to add on just on the OMT, I mean, I sincerely hope, Jean, that you are right. I think the theory, the way you describe it, is very good. The practice, I think, is very different. If Italy asks for QE, for OMT, which I doubt sincerely that it would do, but if it were to do that, other countries would automatically be required to ask for OMT because there would be a contagion effect. This may be a good way of going there, but you can imagine what this will mean in the psyche of certain countries, certainly program countries that have come just out of this. I think politically this is going to be a quite difficult thing to sustain, but who knows? I'm willing to entertain any idea that will make it take us forward.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So I think this is a huge debate, and any ESM OMT will involve lots of politics, both in the receiver countries, but also in the donor countries or in the countries underwriting this. So, you know, every ESM program needs to be approved in the Bundestag, for example, just to give one additional political twist to all of this. I think we could go on for hours now, but I think one thing is clear. This is really an unprecedented situation. It requires unprecedented thinking, and do count on Bruegel to provide you with new ideas and provide you with bold solutions. Do visit our website, and thank you for listening in. It's a pleasure to host this podcast with both of you, Jean and Maria, and I think speak to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you.